You're not a scientist by training.
No, I'm an idiot. I don't know nothing. I was a scientist by interest when I was, like many people, when I was a child. And then in the teenage years of science education, I kind of became bored of it. It seemed to have no reflection on what life was about. Somehow that seems to happen in some science teaching, where the science doesn't seem to reflect the life, even though that's everything that it's about, and the universe and all the things around us. And then probably in my 20s, I started buying science books again, and then slowly got into a different world. In fact, probably quite quickly actually went into a different world after I wrote my first stand-up show, which had quite a bit about science, or at least pseudoscience, kind of just making fun of certain pseudoscientific ideas. Really, then things moved ahead quite quickly.
So who would you say has inspired you? Which scientists have inspired you to be interested in science?
Well, it's a strange way around. The real original inspiration would have been Carl Sagan's Cosmos when I was 11 years old. I think that was on television. And then the way that I got back into science was actually I was in a village in Suffolk, Lavenham, where they filmed Witchfinder General. And I believe it did also have some witch hunting trials as well. And that's how I got back into rationalism, via a town best known for its witch finding. I found a copy of James Randi's Psychic Investigator book. And James Randi, who's kind of, I suppose, one of the leads really in the skeptic movement.
Yeah.
And I read that because I thought, oh, I used to like that show when I was younger. And then that made me read Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World. And then that made me go backwards into the Carl Sagan books I had when I was younger. And so it was that really. It was just as usual as most of my life is. I was, you know, skulking around a bookshop, found a thing. And then that led to me, you know, talking about what I talk about now.
So I attended the Science About Science reception, where you very deservedly won their Standing Up for Science award. And I really loved your acceptance speech because it rang really true for me as a science communicator, where you were talking about your motivations for talking about science and scientific things. And that motivation being a want or a need almost to answer questions about the world that we live in. So what made you move a step further than that, and instead of just finding the answers to those questions, wanting to tell other people about it?
Well, I think a few years ago, I felt that a lot of the media, television, etc., had become, to my eyes, very banal. I don't watch that much television anyway, and I would occasionally walk into a room and see what was on. And I started to think, I'm sure there's lots of people out there who are not really catered for by a lot of the popular media. You know, more and more, that if you look at the number of magazines which are just about the cellulite of people who've been on the OC or whatever else, I thought, I'm sure there's lots of people out here. Much like when I first went to stand-up comedy when I was a teenager, and it wasn't just kind of it was about so many different things, and it was such a way of engaging with different ideas. And so that's why I thought, well, I'm sure people would like to have evenings which might not be hilariously funny, but are filled with people who are interesting. So I started to put on shows in, as usual, in kind of cellars of pubs. I mean, people, I asked Simon Singh very early on, I asked Ben Goldacre, I had various philosophers, had people like Stuart Lee came along and talked about some stuff that he'd found. And it was quite an open, just, I wanted people to talk about, and also part of it was a lot of the stand-up that I was seeing had become cynical or ironic or, you know, this kind of bad taste stand-up, which was generally sneering all the time. And I thought, well, I'd quite like to put on a show that was celebrated. And friends of mine like Josie Long, who's a wonderful stand-up comedian, you know, she's very good also about being enthusiastic. And of course, the danger of being enthusiastic is that it's much easier to shoot someone down if they're enthusiastic. Because if you're just doing a sneering, cynical, making fun out of everyone who is ultimately weaker than you, and then someone takes offence, you go, it's just a joke, innit? Whereas if you've actually said, this is what I really believe, I can't just say this is just a joke, I really love this subject and it's something I'm very passionate about. So that really was what it was driven by, a desire to get across more passionate ideas.
In terms of getting across passionate ideas, do you think that it's important, therefore, that people who aren't necessarily scientists or interested in science know about science? And if so, why?
Well, I don't know if science is, it's very difficult. The moment you use the term science, people read lots of different things into it, and some people just see it as a subject in school, I suppose. And science is really, to me anyway, it is a method of looking at the world, of trying to understand the world, and of looking at each individual, whether it's the tiniest decision you make, or whether it's a momentous decision, whether it's about why trees grow or why you punched your computer when you were furious for not working, you can find answers. Or even if you can't find the answers, at least have your mind open enough to look at things and go, I wonder why that did that. So it's ultimately, I think, more than anything else, it's taking an interest in the world that you're in. And I think also because of the internet is a wonderful place for, I mean, I think it has inspired lots of, one of the reasons of things like the skeptic movement, the science movement, a lot of things that I've done with friends of mine, the internet is a great resource for getting people together who are like-minded from across the world. Also, it's a great resource for new age bamboozlement, for selling miracle cures, and for getting across all manner of strange propaganda. So that was one of the things that I felt. People are under threat from some very woolly thinking that the moment something now appears in print, before you had to get your book published, now merely by the fact it's on your blog, people are starting to respect some quite devious and nefarious ideas. And so to me, one of the most important things is to try and be able to look at the world rationally, to try and be able to ask why someone has written something and why you should believe what they've written, why you should believe their worldview. So I think for all of us to have the tools to understand information. So that's why, the interesting thing is, I think we're at lucky times now because of things like CERN has inspired a generation of children are very excited by these things, as are adults. It's wonderful, you know, when you look at the LHC and what goes on underground, it's quite phenomenal. We have the human genome being mapped. We have, you know, things like child mortality rate, which in the last 50 years has just, or 60 years, you watch that curve just suddenly plummet. But then you see things like the anti-vaccination lobby, and you see things like some of the extremists in the climate change skepticism, and you realize that it's very, very important for us to be able to think critically about the world.
Do you think the sort of, with the rise of things like Skeptics in the Pub and Café Scientifique and the other sort of ways that organisations and people are trying to engage with each other about science and scientific ideas, as well as obviously the shows like yours, like Infinite Monkey Cage, like tonight's Uncaged Monkeys, do you think that they are building momentum? Do you think that rationalism's going to take over the world, or, you know?
Well, I think it's lost some of its threat. I think some people, again, partly from, it can be from school, and partly it can be from the way the media looks at science, and you look at the lack of science reporting quite often in the mainstream media. All of these things, whether it's this, whether it's the Bright Club, whether it's Skeptics in the Pub, whether it's Festival of Spoken Nerd, all of them are quite accessible, and they're going, look, we may not even give you that many answers, but we are going to give you, you're going to leave with lots of questions, and you're going to want to try and find out your own answers. And yes, some of it you may not understand, but don't feel that you're stupid. That's one of the things I think. There have always been great communicators of science, and then there have always been those who have snottily looked down on the great communicators of science. Brian Cox, obviously, I work with quite a lot. I'm endlessly amused by those people who say things like, oh, and he's dumbing down science. And you go, you know what, putting on a show about the heat death of the universe at 9 p.m. on a Sunday night, that's not, talking about entropy isn't dumbing down. Yeah, there may not be that many equations, but it's not a be-all and end-all, it's a starting point. All the shows that I've just talked about are starting points for getting people, then they have to do their own work. So I think at the moment it's fascinating to look at the cross-section of the audience. Like last night, there's a lot of teenagers. It's also great in terms of the gender mix. It's 50-50 men and women. That's greatly helped by the fact that Tim Minchin and Brian are on. You know, ultimately, from an evolutionary point of view, it is helpful as well if you're not too dowdy. But it's great because the people, whatever reasons they're coming to science, are leaving enthused and interested. And I love the fact that I'll often have people come and go, oh, I think you're wrong about this. Brilliant. But as long as it's opening up a discussion, as long as the discussion is open and we're not in this world where, I mean, I've had various people, you know, give me legal threats for things that I've said on stage. And we are living in a strange time where we have this wonderful word that Steve Jones used on Infinite Monkey Cage the other day, which I love. It's mimophant. A mimophant is someone who is, when they're criticising who they see as their opposition, they are an elephant. They trample on everyone. They don't care about what anyone else feels. But should you return fire, they become a mimosa plant. And they go, oh, it's so unfair. I'm only a little flower. And at the moment, there are certain people on what I would really count as the anti-science kind of lobby and different groups who are often threatening legal action. and trying to close down debate a lot. And there are a lot of science writers who are very worried. And I think, again, this kind of open forum where someone is going to see Simon Singh talking about an Enigma machine and Brian Cox talking about how he's suddenly excited by biology after all these years because he's seen that there may well be some quantum behaviour in photosynthesis. All of these things will hopefully inspire people to not just take authority as well. No one who goes on stage in any of these shows is saying, I know what is right. All they want to do is go, I'm giving you some information, but go and question it afterwards as well.
And there's obviously an element of comedy to the show. There has, I think, from a personal perspective, seemed to have been a rise in science in comedy or comedians talking about science. Why do you think that comedy and science make such good bedfellows, if you do?
Well, I think they go well because a lot of what stand-up can be is observational comedy, is looking at the world and sometimes asking why you do those things, why you do that thing in Marks and Spencer's, why men do this and why women do that, etc. And so what science does is, at the same time, science is going, why does that behave like that? So I've always thought the comedians, some of them anyway, are basically lazy and sometimes, you know, just not smart enough to be scientists, but smart enough to have the questions they want to ask. So that's why I think they work well together, because it's to have an investigative mind. So you look at the world and you want to know why it's like that, and you go in front of an audience and you go, hey, why is that like that? Hey, why do electrons behave like that? I don't know what's going on. How can it be there and there? Yeah.
I'd listened to an episode of The Infinite Monkey Cage, not the last one, I think one before, on balance. Mm. And in that, it was very interesting to me as a science communicator, because obviously it was talking about the role of balance in the media and science reporting, and the fact that if you're having a scientific debate, both sides of the debate need to be playing by the same rules. When science is reported in the media, that isn't necessarily the case. And with that in mind, do you think that as part of my job to try and persuade scientists to talk about what they're doing and to communicate it in an accessible way, I'm fighting a losing battle, or I'm doing the wrong thing, and I should actually be leaving it to people like yourself, like Brian Cox, to take that forum?
No, I think everyone should be trying to take that forum. And I think one of the biggest battles, first of all, is that, unfortunately, again, in things like television and newspapers and radio as well, I mean, we see it in the Today programme, where you always have to have an argument. You know, Graham Linehan had that. He's on just to talk about the fact he's doing an adaptation of The Lady Killers, the wonderful Ealing film, and then they have to have someone else on going, but it's not everyone's as happy about. Why do we... Hang on. We don't always have to have an argument. So I think it's up to us sometimes, every single one of us, to write in and to complain and say, look, there didn't need to be an argument here. As scientists, I think, and those who are interested, have to also work out sometimes who to argue with and who not to argue with. I turned down quite a few television and radio things because I often think, well, on these occasions, I think this is going to be one of those, like religion, for instance, because I'm an atheist, I would get asked onto shows to discuss atheism, and they'd always put me opposite someone who's an absolute lunatic, you know, insane prophet style, you know, bloke out of his own shed. And that's not most British religion that I see. So we then end up with this hideous mix where I think a lot of religious people do now believe, because of the way it's reported in the media, that there's this whole cabal of atheists who are ready to crush them, to burn down their churches. Therefore, even though a lot of them are liberal religious people who believe in evolution, believe in the Big Bang Theory, they are being pushed towards believing that they can't be. I mean, all the shows that I do now, I try and communicate as much as possible, going, come on, you know, if you're religious, we're not going to be religious bashing. We might bash a couple of fundamentalists. I mean, I've done Christian festivals and found that it's not a problem. I don't have to change anything that I talk about. One of the things is, firstly, to try and avoid the appearance of arrogance, which I think is actually overplayed. We're always being told that scientists are very arrogant, and I actually don't think they are more than any other group of people. In fact, one of the problems is, you know, arrogance is confused with actually that they're more likely to be right on a lot of the subjects. You know, if you are debating something like climate, if you are debating about evolution, if someone says to me, if a creationist, you know, will come up to me and go, explain the eye then, I can only say to them, well, you're obviously not very interested, because first of all, I'm not a scientist, though I can explain the different stages of the eye. You really would be better off reading any of these books which are currently available in all bookshops. And the fact that every single year there will be another 10 or 20 books which will have a chapter at least on the eye. If you're really interested, these answers are out there. And so we're seeing in the media a lot of people who have strong opinions based on nothing. And we have to try and lose perhaps sometimes some of our liberalism, but at the same time not to be arrogant, to explain why people are going, we see, you know, I'm afraid you haven't really done the reading. And, you know, honestly, this is, we can now try and explain, without being patronising, you know, why your opinion is not founded on the reality that we know at the current time.
Is not, though, the uncertainty that all scientists work with on a daily basis enough in itself to prevent arrogance in scientists?
Well, that's what I think. This is the thing, is people always say how cocksure science is. But where you go is, I always like that term, you know, science is the least wrong ideas we have at any current time. And also the problem with science is people go, oh, either it's just a theory, or even scientists aren't 100% certain about that. And you go, yeah, that's because science... it's not based around 100% certainties. Then it becomes dogma. It started the wonderful end to one of the episodes of Ascent of Man, this beautiful moment where I'm sure you may well have seen it. Jacob Bronowski talks about the difference between science and dogma, particularly talking about fascism in Germany. And he's standing, as far as I remember, it's in Auschwitz, and he talks there as he walks into just a pool of water that could still contain the ashes of human beings who had been, you know, burnt there. And he just, you know, says, you know, this is not science. This is when you believe something 100%. And that is what a lot of the time the arrogant scientists, the apparently arrogant scientists, are actually arguing against people, those people's opinions they believe are 100% true. So I think it's a very difficult balance to get here, which is to avoid laughing at people for believing in stupid things, for understanding why sometimes people believe in things which are not based on any... I mean, homeopathy, I think, has been an interesting one, because there have been various campaigns about this in the last few years. I would say that most people used to believe that homeopathic remedies were just herbal remedies. Most people didn't know what they were. They didn't question.
Yeah.
And they weren't being stupid taking homeopathic remedies. They presumed arnica contained some arnica, and that was it. You know, that was the thing. That was the door there slamming and the whistling of Ben Goldacre, the popular rationalist. So, yes, I think it's a tricky balance to get. But I think also people don't have to be apologetic for saying, look, I can understand why you've got round to the wrong idea. I can understand why you haven't understood this, but let me now explain. You know, the moment you explain to someone about, you know, Samuel Hahnemann and how he came up with the idea of homeopathy and what it actually involves, and you talk about, you know, these lovely facts about acylococcinum, which, as far as I remember, is the cure for flu using duck's liver, and you would actually require more than the water that would exist in the entire universe. Like, the actual statistics are ludicrous enough to go, oh, I didn't really know that. I just thought it was a thing that was... all right for you because it's sold in shops. And that's also been a good way in to persuade people more about kind of rationalism, is because, first of all, it affects their purchases. It affects them financially. So they go, hang on a minute, I've been paying £6 for this little thing of pills, which is actually just sugar pills. It's the return of the sugar pill. Oh, yeah. They go, oh, okay. And then that's a doorway through an actual personal experience into questioning more stuff.
So it's
always about, it's never about the answers to me. It's always about just questioning things. I was talking about this with Tim Minchin this afternoon. We were having lunch and we were going, you know, we don't know that much about climate change. Both of us have read a certain number of books and articles. We are such a distance from being authorities, but you can look and go, right, now these people writing about this, oh, that's their specialist subject, that's their specialist subject, that's the area that person spends a lot of time getting samples of ice and finding out the different things that the change in the atmosphere through taking large samples up. Right, okay, and that person has an English degree from Oxford University, and that, hang on a minute, and you go, well, you can start to weigh up. And it's not an opinion from authority. It's an opinion from going, that's their area. That's what they look at. That's a speciality.
So moving away from climate change into microbiology, it gets a lot of bad press. There's a lot of headlines along the lines of, there are more bugs on your mobile phone than on a toilet seat. We're all going to die. What's your perception of microbiology?
Well, it gets more and more exciting the more I read books by Carl Zimmer, who I love. Is it Microcosmos or is it just Microcosm?
I think it's Microcosm.
And I've got a lovely, his recent book, which is just some lovely pictures of various different types of virus. It's very exciting. So, I mean, even that alone has opened people's eyes. Once they find out that wonderful thing that Walt Whitman mentioned in a poem and then Carl Sagan also used, you know, we are a multitude. All of the things that are within us, the fact that there is life around us and within us all the time operating, that we are basically citadels filled with other stuff that is going on within us and other living creatures. I find all of these things and how some of these things have survived and how, for instance, well, even microbiology in terms of looking at the theory of evolution. This is, you know, when you get down to some of those levels, you can see evolution in action for people who say, oh, well, you can't actually, well, why can't we we see a giraffe growing a trunk. And you go, well, you see, when you're looking at the very big... It's a bit like when people go, why hasn't this fish, for instance, changed in 50 million years if evolution exists? And you go, well, evolution, you don't have to change for evolution. You only have to make sure. It's like the lovely example of the tree kangaroo, which is terrible at climbing, but it doesn't matter that it's very bad at climbing because it has no particular competition. Therefore, that's why it's a rubbish climber. So, but then, yeah, getting down to microbiology, that's one of the reasons I find that quite exciting, is because you can see in action certain ideas which people believe they cannot see examples of.
Yeah. It is a fascinating subject. I would say that I'm a bit biased. But having listened to your podcast recently about balance, I think at the end of it, everybody was asked what their favourite un-fact was. So on the flip side to that, initially, what's your favourite fact?
Do you know what? It changes. So, I mean, today, it's the fact that when you're looking at the size of superstrings, if it basically, I can't remember the, I'm not going to do this by numbers, but if you go the size of the knowable universe compared to the Earth is the same as the size of an electron compared to the size of a superstring. So that's my favourite thing, because okay. It makes you a bit dizzy. So that once has, you get yes. to those things, so that's one of my favourite facts. And I've been reading a lot about Arthur Eddington and Ernest Rutherford today, just because obviously we're in Manchester and they did much of their work there. But every single day the fact will change. That's one of the things that I enjoy. And I was just reading Richard Feynman's piece about seeing the all of science in a glass of wine as well. So every single day, yeah, there's...
Explain the all of science in a glass of wine. I'm a big wine fan myself.
Oh, well, I'll read it out tonight. I was thinking okay. of reading it out tonight.
Oh,
so, yeah,
great.
You'll see it later
Excellent.
On.
Excellent. I'll...
But it's a lovely piece of Feynman where he goes through all the different processes, looking at the glass, understanding the behaviour, understanding the fermentation, and therefore the life that goes on within the creation of the glass of wine, and the fact that at the end of it you can forget it all and you can just drink the glass of wine.
Sounds good. Thank you very much,
Thank
Robin.
You.
Really appreciate you being interviewed, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing the show later.
Brilliant. I hope you don't screw it up.